Welcome to the Farmers Weekly Podcast, this episode recorded on Friday the 21st of January 2022. From the Farmers Weekly News Desk, I'm Johan Tasker.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
In this episode, we meet the candidates vying for the NFU's top office holder jobs.
How farmers are helping to tackle phosphate pollution.
On the markets, are high prices affecting the supply of fertiliser onto farm?
And we meet the farmers turning sheep's milk into vodka.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
But first, DEFRA this week launched the latest tranche of farm technology grants available to producers. £25 million is being made available to fund projects that involve robotics and slurry acidification. A 40% grant rate is available. Earlier, I spoke to Farming Minister Victoria Prentice. We also discussed the recent Public Accounts Committee report that criticised DEFRA's ELM scheme. But first, I started by asking her, had certain farm sectors been targeted in this latest grant scheme?
So the goals, if you like, are improving productivity, improving the environment, and introducing innovation. It is definitely true that we do have some targets, which the dairy sector can undoubtedly help us with. So some of this, yes, is talking about slurry, and slurry applications will be warmly welcomed. And indeed, it's fair to say that we are very ambitious as a department in terms of increasing productivity in horticulture, but those are by no means all we're after. So I would encourage really anybody with a sensible application to have a go on our online checker and see if it is a strong application and worth pursuing.
So if you've gone through the grant checker process, Minister, and your project doesn't effectively tick the boxes, is it still worth pursuing?
If you have another idea or a slightly different ask, then I would encourage farmers to try the application process. And if they want to pursue it further, then engage with us directly or engage with the RPA directly. We have a whole variety, as you know, of different funds of different values within the sort of overall farming investment fund. And we are genuinely open to new ideas that people want to share with us.
Minister, last week the Public Accounts Committee published a damning report following its inquiry looking at the ELMS scheme. How do you respond to that? This is, after all, your flagship policy for farming in England.
Well, we don't recognise all of their findings, though we will, of course, engage with all sorts of people who are interested in our schemes, including Mr. Clifton Brown, who I know well and I frequently talk to about all matters farming. What I would say is that this is a really difficult period of real change for our agricultural sector. And there are bound to be people that are challenged by that change and who are finding it genuinely difficult to adapt to what is a completely new way of rewarding us for producing public goods. I have been really impressed by the willingness of the agricultural world to engage with our policies. And I think perhaps the best evidence I've got for that is countryside stewardship applications, which have gone up by 30%, over 30% in the last year, which really shows me that the farming world is up for this and is willing to join in.
The industry was quite critical of the sustainable farming incentive, the SFI rates that were published at the beginning of December, and many people saying people just aren't going to take part. It's not worth their while. Are you worried that farmers just aren't going to engage? You're going to go off doing policy in one direction, and farmers are just going to go in the other.
No, I would use the countryside stewardship applications as evidence of that. I think people are up for this. I think farmers are going out of their way to apply. After all, we're still in the pilot stage of SFI. And we've only just begun to put the flesh on the bones of our other two tiers. So these are very early days. days. But I do think what is available is being taken up by farmers. We've had really good applications to our Farming Investment Fund various rounds. And I think people understand that the world is changing, the way they're rewarded and the way their businesses can be grown with some help from government is changing, and they're really trying to get on board.
Does it worry you that food production, though, still isn't key centre to your or a major component of the department's 25-year plan, given that you will need, if you are to deliver that plan, many in the industry are saying you will need viable farm businesses which produce food on which to be able to deliver your plan?
Of course we will. Food businesses are absolutely what we're all about. We're about to publish our response to Henry Dimbleby's food strategy, which was an independent report, and we're about to publish a government's response to that. And I've been partially working on that this morning. And that will make it very, very clear that growing food is very, very much part of what we think we need to be helping with in DEFRA. And of course, it's what farmers do.
So will we see the 25-year plan amended accordingly once the Dimbleby report has been officially responded to?
I don't think there's any need for that at all. I think our food response will make it quite clear that we can be ambitious across our portfolio, if you like.
That's Farming Minister Victoria Prentice.
So, Hugh, this productivity grant, is it really going to make a difference?
I think it can. There is some good stuff in here, it's limited in the sense that it's aimed at predominantly robotics across all sectors, but the standout ones are horticulture and dairy and slurry. The slurry grant part is all around slurry acidification, which is, for those of you who don't know about slurry acidification, that is part of the government's deal of tackling ammonia pollution. We've mentioned this before, that agriculture is responsible for about 88% of the UK's diffuse ammonia that goes into the atmosphere. And one way that you can cut this down by about 50% is by acidifying slurry before you put it into the lagoon. It sort of locks it up so it doesn't oxidize and release the ammonia back into the atmosphere. It's widely used in the continent. Denmark is a big place because they've had a real push on ammonia there, but it's not really been used much here at all.
Well, that's slurry and that kind of thing. I mean, there seems to be a big focus on robotics and stuff like that. But what about everything else?
Yeah, I mean, look, if you go online, there's an online checking tool that you can go through, and it asks you about your project, and it sort of tells you whether you've got a weak, strong, or middling chance of success. So you go on that, you click through it. When you get to the end of it, depending on the outcome, you can then submit that survey, if you will, and then the RPA will invite you to apply fully for the full grant. You've also got to remember that this is the sort of higher end stuff. So the maximum grants or the minimum amount you can claim is about 35 grand. It's a 40% rate. So that would mean minimum spend of about 87,500. But grants are available up to £500,000. So bearing in mind that the total pot, though, is 25 million. It's not, you know, it could potentially get used up quite quickly. But yes, it is generally all around the robotics end of the market. And some people have said that, you know, that's fine, but it's not the be-all and end-all, and perhaps we should be funding other things as well. Now, one person that said that is Rob Hitch, who we hear from quite often with our budget coverage. He's an accountant up near Carlisle for Dodd & Co., and he has lots of dairy farmer clients, and this is what he had to say when I asked him about the robotics angle of these grants.
The smaller end of farms, you know, 100, 200 cows that need new parlours, robots look quite attractive. For the larger farms, I'm not convinced particularly sort of milking robots is the answer. You still need people to manage cows. And I think parlours can deliver almost as much productivity gain, but you know, for some reason, the government never seemed to want to fund better parlours than people have already. They just fund the robot side of things. Robots generally cost £80,000 a pop. If you've 500 cows and you need perhaps six robots, that's £500,000. You can build a very good parlour for less than that. If that delivers the same sort of labour savings overall, you know, robots don't open gates or trim cows' feet or get the slow one out of the cubicle. You know, you still need people to chase things about and do bits and pieces.
So that's Rob Hitch there saying that robots aren't the be-all and end-all, as we know. But look, these grants will be useful to some people, and they'll be particularly useful, I think, potentially on the slurry side, as a lot of producers venture into areas like slurry acidification, which we don't have a great deal of expertise of in the UK. I say it's very popular in the continent. So getting a 40% grant for that is a good thing. I suppose the big question is, will there be enough, given that the public, the ceiling on this is 25 million, will there be enough to go round? We'll have to wait and see.
I mean, it is all about money, Hugh, isn't it? The other thing that stood out for me in that audio was this big increase in countryside stewardship applications. Victoria Prentice seems to see that as a success for DEFRA, but at least some of that uplift is going to be because people are desperately trying to find a way to replace income that's being lost as the basic payment is being phased out.
Absolutely. She came back on that. That was her sort of defence line, if you were, against the criticism of the Public Accounts Committee report around the Elms and Elms development. Yeah, you're right. It's people thinking, heck, what can we replace BPS with? Also, bear in mind that a lot of country stewardship and HLS schemes are expiring. They're coming to the end of their natural life. Generally, they were 10-year deals. There's a lot of that cascading now as well. So it's not surprising. There's a lot of pickup of applications going through. So yes, it's their defense line. Clearly, you know, she's obviously not going to say, yes, we've got it wrong. There's a lot of change. There's a lot of churn. It will be interesting to see what DEFRA's response back to the PAC report is, what they accept as criticism and what they don't.
Interesting comments too on food security, but again, this ongoing reluctance to put anything in writing.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's like, you know, there's the 25-year plan and we have to do all this stuff, but we're not going to mention food just in case. I have no idea. It could be that they do actually do something on the response to the Dimbleby report. You heard in the audio, they're preparing that response. She'd been working on it the morning I spoke to her. It could come out next week or the week after. So perhaps it's going to tie in with the NFU conference at the end of February. I don't know. So it might be that they do actually change something. We'll have to wait and see. But at the moment, this sort of, yeah, complete denial of the fact that food comes from farms and we therefore don't need to put it in our policy, which is still, to many people, a bit bonkers.
Every day, British farming is facing new challenges. At AHDB, we're here to help. We invest in your future by delivering work that moves our industry forward. We're here to fund research, share knowledge, and grow markets. But it's time for a fresh start and a more open conversation. We need your voice on how we spend your levy. In April 2022, you'll get the chance to help set the direction for AHDB. Register before 31st of March, and together we can shape the future of British farming. Visit ahdb.org.uk/shape the future.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, a dangerous chemical cocktail is coursing through UK rivers and waterways. That's according to an influential committee of MPs. The build-up of high levels of nutrients, such as phosphorus and nitrogen, from sewage and animal waste is choking rivers, says the Environmental Audit Committee. Intensive livestock and poultry farming is putting enormous pressure on particular catchments, including the River Wye in Herefordshire, it says. Now, we're not suggesting for a moment that there isn't a problem here, but some farmers are trying to do the right thing. Martin Williams, who farms next to the River Wye, has stopped applying sewage cake and has reduced his use of chicken litter in an effort to prevent phosphate losses to water.
I used to spread sewage cake for the water company in the county, and I used it myself to increase my indices, which on rented land and bits and pieces that I'd got, it seemed a cheap way of doing it. I now stopped using that because my indices are where I feel I'm comfortable with them. They're not over the top. And so I've stopped using that. We're using chicken litter less than we were. We were using it sort of as a broad brush. We're using that a lot less. We're using it targeting it. Not every field gets it every year. So, yes, we are limiting what we're using. I don't buy any compound fertilizer at all. Nothing. We just rely on a bit of farmyard manure, which we still use, not extensively, but we use what we can get hold of over the acreage in rotation. So, yes, we are managing inputs as every farmer is, but perhaps we're being a little bit more cute than we once were.
That's Martin Williams. So what else can farmers do to reduce pollution? Soil scientist Simon Fox from Emerald Research.
Well, once we've established the availability of phosphate in the soils, we would then recommend the best way, the best approach is not to be broadcasting phosphate at all, as you are essentially throwing it away. The best thing to be doing is to be placing phosphate close to where the crop can get hold of it after planting, whether that be cereals or potatoes or any other crop. So banded applications of phosphate and associated nutrition. And then actually following that with a foliar program where the efficiency is close to 100% as opposed to 5 to 10% as it is with soil-applied phosphates.
And some people listening to this will say, well, you know, Simon would be saying this because this is exactly the business that you're involved in. But it has many benefits. It can be applied to a wide range of crops and it reduces the pollution risk, yeah?
Well, that's entirely right. The reason I'm involved in this as a business is because I started with an understanding the availability of phosphate to the crop and realised quickly that the broadcast applications of phosphate and soil applied applications of phosphate are highly inefficient and do not fit the modern world, and therefore devolving and creating forms of phosphate that could be applied more efficiently, and foliar is by far and away the most efficient once you have a sufficient canopy, is a highly effective means of achieving this.
That's Simon Fox. Maize specialist Neil Groom from Grainseed says there are other things farmers can do as well.
One way that phosphate can get into the watercourses is through runoff from maize stubbles after harvest, for instance, after heavy rains. But we're encouraging growers to plant their maize earlier because if you drill a month earlier in the spring, say in the middle of April instead of the middle of May, then you'll bring your harvest date forward at the other end of the season. So if we can get the maize harvested in September in good conditions, then we've got an opportunity of maybe doing a grass reseed or drilling winter corn so that we've got a growing crop on the maize stubble through next winter, which will then increase rainfall infiltration and reduce the amount of potential runoff that we get off the field, which would be carrying the soil particles containing the phosphate into the river system.
That's Neil Groom from Grainseed.
So, Johan, how exactly are these producers? Obviously, they've come under criticism for this phosphate pollution. Some are saying it's nothing to do with them at all. But what are the producers doing proactively on the ground then?
Well, you heard there from Martin Williams. He's not applying P and K at all. You know, he's using the sort of taking advantage of the residual nutrients within the soil to not apply anything. And then once those indices, as it were, have come down, he'll then just continue to use maintenance applications to keep the levels where he needs them to be. But I mean, you know, this is not something that's just about the River Wye. I think you know, there's a broader thing here. Again, you know, MPs having a pop at farming and saying that agriculture is among the main polluters. There are various things that are trying to be done that people are doing. The different options, phosphate stripping technology, manure applications and treatment options, and also sort of supply chain interventions too, that these are all options so that workable guidance can be put in place for appropriate manure use. I think the message is, though, Hugh, you've got to test and see what you need to apply, and then apply the right quantities at the right time.
So it's just good common sense housekeeping in terms of keeping on top of your nutrients and your soil indices, and obviously going ahead with these resources becoming more and more scrutinised and potentially more expensive, as we've seen at the moment, people will just be doing it. Is there other sort of wider, more environmental things that the land managers can do to try and sort of effectively buffer this situation, such as, you know, management strips near watercourses, that sort of thing?
Yeah, there's things like foliar applications as well, putting nutrients where they need to be rather than just sort of, you know, spreading them right across the field and that kind of thing. I think technology is going to have a big part to play. I mean, again, you know, we're down to this thing of, on the one hand, DEFRA wants farmers to improve soil health, and it sees things like manure, farmyard manure, as being a key part of that. And then you've got the Environment Agency saying, you know, no, we don't want any autumn spreading of manure. It's potentially dangerous. It's a pollutant, et cetera, et cetera. So it's about getting the right balance.
And it's about quantifying it, because part of the argument with the EA proposed regs at the moment, or their regs at the moment, which you're hoping they're going to change, is that they treat everything the same, you know, whether it's manure, slurry, digestate, which they're not. So it's knowing what you're handling, how you're handling it, and what soil you're putting it onto. In terms of the Wye Valley context, that's bringing where lots of producers are working together around this specific issue. That in itself is quite unique, though, isn't it?
It is unique. I mean, Martin Williams is probably the farmer at the forefront of this, or certainly one of the farmers at the forefront of this. He's stopped applying sewage cake. He's reduced his use of chicken litter. He's trying to prevent soil and phosphate losses to water. He's doing everything right. He's introduced buffer strips, 6-metre margins, and he's also establishing permanent grass by the river so that the watercourses have protection. So it's possible to do lots and lots of different things. And I think, you know, that's what I wanted to highlight in this piece, that it's all very well for MPs to talk about a cocktail of chemicals flowing through our rivers and watercourses, but there are people out there that are doing the right thing.
Absolutely. And by acting together as a group of producers, they can really have some impact in terms of this whole catchment area.
That's right. I mean, you know, you can do your bit, but if other people aren't doing their bit in the same catchment, you know, it's not going to make too much difference. So it's about people coming together, working together, indeed, you know, probably working with the Environment Agency and NGOs and learning from each other and the challenges and opportunities that there are, and trying to put things right.
CFN MinTest is the only soil test in the UK to accurately measure nitrogen for the whole of the crop growing season. The test can help to improve crop yield, quality and environment. For further information, please search CFN MinTest online.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You're indeed listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. A very warm welcome wherever you happen to be listening to us from. Do not forget, if you would like to get in touch with us here on the podcast, you can. The best way is to email us, podcast@fwi.co.uk. That is podcast@fwi.co.uk.
We've got three emails this week, Hugh. They're all good. They're all good. The first one: my name is Estelle. I'm originally from Leicester and I now live in Melbourne, Australia. My husband and I love your podcast. We started listening a few months ago when we moved to our new home on 5 acres in the beautiful Victorian countryside. We may not be a 1,000-acre farm, but we've got chickens. We're trying our hand at growing veggies, and kangaroos help mow our grass. Estelle says, I was listening to your segment this week on DEFRA's 25-year plan, and I have to wonder if George Eustace is a secret Alan Partridge fan. Evolution, not revolution, is a classic Alan Partridge quote and seen from the 1997 series of I'm Alan Partridge. And as a huge Partridge fan myself, I was laughing hearing it in your podcast.
That's really funny. It's actually, It was actually Tony Hares that said, it was Alan was quoting Tony Hares, who was just sacking him in the BBC executive dining room. And then he quoted him saying, you said revolution, not evolution. And then Tony Hares says to him, no, I said evolution, not revolution. So there we go.
So, it was, so what you're saying, Hugh, is that Estelle is quoting George Eustace, quoting Alan Partridge, quoting the other chap.
Tony Hares, yes. He's also the actor David Schneider. But yes, it was actually Tony Hares that said evolution, not revolution, in his fictitious Guardian piece. I can't believe we're talking about this. In his fictitious Guardian piece about his job as BBC commissioning editor. So perhaps George Eustace borrowed his lines from the Tony Hares book of BBC management. Who knows?
A very good observation indeed. So thank you very much, Lattice. Just keep up the good work with the podcast. It's a great listen. So that's good. You'll also remember, Hugh, we had an email last week from dairy farmer Bob from Northern Ireland, who gave us a 5-star review, but also had some constructively critical comments about our lack of Northern Irish coverage. He's come up with some ideas. The development of a Northern Ireland bovine TB eradication strategy, what Northern Ireland farmers need out of the current protocol negotiations, this is the whole Northern Ireland border situation, a land mobility scheme, and also this idea of achieving special status for Irish grass-fed beef. Bob, we're going to have to take you up on at least one of those stories, I think, and get that done within the next few weeks. I hope I'm not making a rob from my own back here, but we will cover at least one of those stories. And then finally, we've got another email from Anthea Wood, who says she's a new fan of the Farmers Weekly podcast. You are always saying you want to hear about who's listening and where you listen from, so I thought I'd email in. I'm an artist and printmaker, and I've really recently started listening to the Farmers Weekly podcast in my studio. So there we have it to you. 3 emails this week in the Farmers Weekly inbox, podcast@fwi.co.uk.
Anthea, thank you so much for that, and I hope this adds to the artistic ambiance and creativity that is in your studio as you listen. Thank you so much for taking the time to email. We also had another 5-star review this week. It's also got some constricted. I love how these reviews are 5-star, but they contain constructive criticism. It's the best. Great show, gives a great insight into what's going on in farming on a macro and micro level. However, don't forget about us chicken farmers. Any content on that would be much appreciated. So perhaps we could kill 2 birds with 1 stone, Johan, and do a feature on Northern Irish chicken farmers. Perhaps that could be the way forward. Ben Williams, thank you so much for taking the time to write that review, and thank you for listening. As Johan said earlier, it is podcast@fwi.co.uk. That's podcast@fwi.co.uk if you'd like to get in touch.
But for now, Hugh, the markets, what's happening?
Thank you, Johan. The finished steer deadweight average for this week, 408.4. That's back ever so slightly from last week. It was 409. The live weight average goes back about 5p to 227.9. Sheep markets just starting to ease back a little bit at the moment. The SQQGB deadweight average this week, 601.1. It's back from 614 last week. And the live weight jumps back about 7p to 263.4. Arable markets also just cooling off this week. Feed week, 210.10, £210.10 back from 213 last week. Milling wheat drops back about £5 to £248.50. Feed barley drops back a pound to £202.80. And even oilseed rape has come back slightly this week, coming back to £582, back from £613.20 last week. Now, one thing which is top of everyone's mind at the moment, whatever you're growing, and if you use fertiliser, is the price of fertiliser. It's been at some record highs, as we know, for the last few months. That's because of record gas prices across the world. Those prices show no signs of easing as gas prices stay high. But will those high prices delay purchases? And is there a risk that it could delay product getting onto farm to growers. Joe Gilbertson heads up the fertiliser team at the Agricultural Industries Confederation.
Looking at the data that's available to us from members, we haven't seen a fall off in either orders or ability to supply running up to Christmas. I think that's testament to one, farmers understanding the need for fertilizer and the value that that gives to their crops and yields, and also to the fact that our members have been able to maintain supplies as required, despite the price.
Given that we import more fertiliser here than we actually produce, does that make us more vulnerable in a global context in terms of supply and pricing issues?
I think we're in a good position because we've got a mix of domestic and import that sort of help stabilise each other normally and under normal circumstances. That puts us in a better position than perhaps countries such as Ireland that are completely import dependent, because that introduces an element of competition. But in this particular instance, everybody's affected because it is a European-wide issue that's been largely driven by the price of gas. And I think it's fair to say that normally the majority of our imported supplies would come from Europe. So it's testament, I think, again, to the strength of the UK industry as a whole that they've been able to maintain sourcing and matching the orders. One of the problems I think we've got to make listeners aware of is the fact that supply chains are lengthening as a result of restrictions. Also, they need to be aware that the circumstances surrounding the ability of suppliers to get haulage organised for deliveries is not as flexible as it used to be either. So, you know, ordering good time is still our message.
Back in the summer, when the government was faced with a CO2 crisis, it was reported that the government had subsidised fertiliser production to keep that going on. And there are reports now that that subsidy runs out at the end of this month. Is that likely to have an impact on supply?
If I can just sort of correct that, I think that's a popular misconception that there's been state subsidy in the UK. The facts of the matter, and this was reported in Hansard on the 17th of this month, actually, by Minister Prentice, who was quoted as saying that government only stepped in because of the CO2 immediate crisis for a period of 3 weeks in September, and subsequently the matter has been dealt with purely through private contracts. So this is not a government state subsidy as far as I'm aware, and therefore this is really all to do with genuine availability of nitrogen fertilisers as a result of gas prices. But that's a European-wide thing, not a UK problem alone.
That's Joe Gilbertson, who is the head of the fertiliser team at the AIC.
Smaller but perfectly designed, meet the new MF4700M and MF5700M series from Massey Ferguson. Discover robust, innovative and practical tractors meeting the everyday challenges of sustainable farming. The right level of technology, comfort and performance at all times. From 82 to 135 horsepower, there's a model perfect for your farm business. 3 and 4 cylinder stage 5 engines pack a powerful punch, and these combine with the superbly engineered 12x12 gearbox or the renowned Dyna4 transmission. With up to 5.2 tonnes lift capacity, these tractors are suited to a wide range of livestock and loader operations, field work and transport. All models are equipped with a host of modern features, high specification, and are available with a range of options and accessories. Speak to your local MF dealer today or visit masseyferguson.co.uk for special offers and with 0% finance available.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now this week, online hustings took place as part of the process of electing the NFU's top office holders. The elections, which take place every 2 years, are for the president, the deputy president and the vice president. The five candidates are Manette Batters, who's standing for president. Tom Bradshaw is standing for deputy president. John Davis is standing for deputy and vice president. David Exwood is standing for vice president. And Thomas Warnham is also standing for vice president. We caught up with them all earlier on and asked them about themselves and what they wanted to do should they be elected to office.
My name's Manette Batters. I'm president of the National Farmers Union. And I started out as very much a grassroots member, I have to say, with no idea of what the NFU did. My dad had paid his sub, told me to pay my sub, which I duly did. Got involved with the NFU when I was looking at doing a Nuffield study. And before I knew it, I was actually county chairman of Wiltshire. And I very much hope that I've led the NFU and always focused on effectively leadership. We've campaigned, but we've also worked out policy solutions for wherever there is a problem. And that was key to me when I came in as president 4 years ago. I felt we had to campaign a lot more. We had to get farming's voice out there. We had to talk more about food, more about the environment, and hence the ambition laying down the gauntlet, if you like, at the Oxford Farming Conference to achieve net zero by 2040 with the right policies. So it's been hard graft. I'm not going to say this has been easy. It's been hard graft to get what we've got. But, you know, we've got the statutory underpinning of the Trade Agriculture Commission. That took 1 million people to get that in place. We've got a seasonal workers scheme of 40,000, a permanent scheme now accessing 40,000. I was told continually it would be 10. So there's a lot of things that we have got over the line. The Sustainable Farming Incentive, ALMS in general, there is a lot more work to do to make that fit for purpose. I think the NFU is well backed by the National Audit Office, the Public Accounts Committee. There's a lot more to do on that to get it really match fit and economically viable for farmers. So that's why I'm standing again. I feel there's unfinished business, but I hope I've proved my worth.
I'm Tom Bradshaw, currently NFU Vice President and standing for election as Deputy President. I farm in Essex. I'm the fourth generation farming with my parents and my wife, Emily. We grow a range of combinable crops, mainly contract farming, and then the home farm is arable with some diversification as well. We're in a defining moment of change within the agricultural industry, and particularly within the new policy development. I think I've just demonstrated over the last 2 years the breadth of knowledge across the policy area. I've done my utmost to deliver for members, but there's still a lot of unfinished business that we've got to get right. The agricultural transition is very much in turmoil, I would suggest. You know, there's a lot of work to do to make sure that it really does work for members' businesses. Now, I feel I've got a lot to offer that, if I was looking at different policy areas in the future. So I'd like to think I've done things pretty well for the last 2 years. It's been a very different 2 years, but I'd be really excited to continue the job for the next 2 years. We've got to absolutely focus on the things that are affecting members' businesses today. And if members speak to me, it's either about farming rules for water, it's about Red Tractor, it's about inflation, or the agricultural transition, particularly around the SFI. These are things that are going to affect members now, and we've got to get them right. We've got to make sure that policy genuinely supports productive agriculture.
My name's John Davis. We farm here in Mid Wales. We farm beef, sheep, and we do a little bit of agricultural contracting as well. I farm in partnership with my wife, my son and my father. It's a typical hill farm, and we grow grass and quite a lot of some arable as well for the cattle to finish the cattle. Obviously, it's up to every member to look at the candidates and make their own choice, but I'm really passionate about agriculture. It's a job I love. It's a profession I chose. I'm really keen to create opportunity for the next generation. I think we've got a fantastic story to tell as UK farmers, and I think it's really important that we shout it from the rooftops. Climate change is front and centre at the moment, and there's a lot of talk about red meat and veganuary. But if we look at the way we produce food here in the UK, it's got some of the lowest carbon footprints in the world. And I think we've got to prove and validate that effectively now. So we've got to be transparent and open. I think there's a lot of opportunity to focus on productivity. All of these small gains, you know, we need to pick those up. But I think we can lead the world. Let's be ambitious here to lead the world in climate-friendly, nature-friendly food production.
I'm David Exwood. I'm a tenant farmer from Sussex, and we farm just about everything here. We have a lot of dairy cows we rear right through. We have supper cows, sheep, pigs, arable acres, and a thriving farm shop. And I absolutely love farming. Farming is a real passion of mine. I'm currently chair of NFU South East, and I'm also on governance board of the NFU. I've grown up, lived and worked with farming people all my life, you know, right through from young farmers, right the way through to management courses, and starting with working by myself and just having one tractor and a dog and not a lot else, and growing my business. I understand and have a passion for farming and the people of farming, and I really want to stand up for them. There's a lot of change coming. There's a lot of challenges. People feel, you know, they're going to need helping and guiding through the next few years, and they're going to need standing up for that. I want to represent them and fight their corner, make it as easy as possible for them to have profitable businesses, because that's the core of a good farming industry. Some of the actual real things on the ground that make a difference to people. So rules for water, TB, you know, these are the day-to-day issues that really make a difference to farmers' businesses. So some of that legislation, making sure people can do the business of farming, they can get on with it. And really, I think my top priority is next generation farmers. You know, we've got to bring on a new generation of younger farmers. They're the ones that are going to adapt and solve the many problems we've got coming. They're the ones that have got the fresh and open minds. And I really want to do all I can to help them get in and get farming, as so many of them want to do.
I'm Thomas Warnham. I am a fourth generation arable and poultry farmer in North Hertfordshire. I have spent 4 years as the NFU poultry chair, and I have spent another 4 years as the vice chair on the poultry board. I have also been Hertfordshire county chair, and I've also chaired our local branch meeting as well. I have been chair of the poultry board for the last 4 years, and during my period of time there, I have tried to promote alternative proteins as a way of improving the environmental credentials for the poultry industry. I've stuck myself back into further education to learn and broaden my understanding of agriculture from a different perspective, not just purely from an agricultural perspective. My top priority would be to get farmers to engage with ELMS and our environment, because I think that affects the majority of landowners in the UK. From there, trying to focus on fair trade deals across the globe to make sure that the UK isn't undermined by inferior products coming to the UK would be another key area of interest for me. I am just adamant that education and engagement with young kids is something we really need to prioritise.
So, Hugh, not many candidates standing for election in to join the NFU top table, to be an office holder. That would suggest that maybe people are perhaps happy with what they've got.
Yeah, I think there's possibly several reasons why that's the case, depending on obviously who you speak to in the room. Some people saying people are quite happy with the candidates that are on offer and the work that's been done by some of the incumbent office holders up until this point. Therefore, why challenge it too hard? It certainly isn't an offering that we saw, you know, 10 years ago, I think it was. We had up to sort of 12 or 14 candidates in the room across all the three positions. It's not as crazy as that. Also, a good point made by one person I asked about, and they said, well, you know, the last couple of years have been pretty tough for everybody in terms of meetings and getting together. And if you're an up and coming new talent within NFU Council that wants to get out there and shine, it's harder to do it potentially through Zoom than it is if you're actually in the room together. So that could be another reason why. And then as one person I spoke to is quite rude about the whole thing, I said, well, that just reflects the talent that's in the room. But hey, draw from all of those what you will.
NFU President Minette Batters is, of course, standing again. She'll be uncontested, but there will be at least one change because Stuart Roberts, Deputy President, is standing down.
Yeah, there could be two changes, let's not forget. But yes, the potential is for one change. Stuart Roberts stands down. Tom Bradshaw is standing for that position. Also, John Davis, who is currently the NFU, Welsh NFU president, he finishes his term and he's put his name on both the deputy positions. He wants to come across and see what he can do for the main NFU, as it were, which is, of course, the NFU of England and Wales.
John's decision to stand for as a candidate, I think for me, is the most interesting thing, because agriculture is devolved. He's got a lot of experience when it comes to Wales in terms of negotiating with politicians, representing the sector there. Do you think he could make the transition, as it were, to become deputy or vice president of NFU England and Wales?
There's no reason at all why you couldn't. I mean, you could argue the fact that, you know, he could bring some of the ideas from the devolved regulation in Wales over the border into England, and that may be a benefit or it may be a hindrance. But, you know, he's done what he's done there. He's finishing his NFU Cymru position as president as this potential next chapter for him could start. So we'll just have to wait and see. But there's no reason at all why someone that's only worked in Wales couldn't come over and effectively be on the top table, because, as you said, it's the NFU of England and Wales, despite there being, if you will, the sort of separate part. It's effectively a region, and it has its own identity in terms of NFU Cymru.
And not forgetting that there are two other candidates as well, David Exwood and Tom Warnham.
Yeah, David Exwood, he's from my part of the world, from the South East. He's been the chair of the South East Board for a long time here in the South East. He stood for election last time round. He's going for it again. And then Tom Warnham, who, as you heard in the audio there, is from Hertfordshire. He currently chairs the NFU's Poultry Commodity Board, and he's having a go as well.
Hugh, there will be some of our listeners, I don't know how many, there might be a lot of our listeners who'll be listening to this and think, goodness me, you know, why does all this matter? It's just NFU, NFU, NFU. Why does it matter?
I think it matters because the NFU is one of the leading lobbying organisations within the sort of farming and rural policy domain. There are other organisations, there are other devolved NFUs within the British Isles. There's the CLA, there are other trade bodies, but the NFU is one of the leading ones. And I think it matters because who is at the top of that organisation will have some bearing on the leadership and the direction of that organisation. And that will, by default, have an impact potentially on what happens on farms within the country, whether you're an NFU member or not. Then that's quite harsh for some people to swallow. And I get that not everyone is an NFU member. I am, and I happen to think they do a great job, and I've always supported them, and I've been a part of some of that stuff that's gone on within the NFU. So yeah, it does matter. And you know, it's a democratic organisation like all of these organisations, and it means if people don't like the way it's going, they can stand up and have their say and potentially be elected. So it's not a bad thing. And also, credit where credit's due to these individuals who are getting off their backsides. They are standing up and they are standing on a podium and saying what they believe. And that's to be applauded as well, because it's not the easiest thing to do, particularly not that easy in the current climate where they had to have online hustings and it's difficult to get out there and speak to people. So fair play to them for having a go. The reason it matters is because it's a fairly big player when it comes to lobbying within the sort of rural domain. And don't forget, if you want to influence that and you are an NFU member, the way that it works is that all the council members, which represent all the counties and the county chairmen that are on the council, they will have the vote at the conference on the 23rd of February. So you need to get onto your local representative like that and tell them who you think they should be voting for.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, vodka is usually made from grain, grapes or potatoes, but Cotswold farmers Tim and Tanya Spittle have started making it from sheep's milk. Black Lion Vodka is a premium triple distilled vodka produced using whey, a byproduct of the cheese-making process. I caught up with Tim and asked him all about it.
About 4 years ago, we were thinking about doing something that would be sustainable for our farm, to pass our farm down through the generations. And, you know, we're sheep farmers of old, and we were looking for something that was new, exciting, something that hadn't been done before. And we realized there were some cow's milk vodkas out there. And we thought, well, if the cows can do it, the sheep can. So we looked into it. It's taken 4 years in development. And we now have a super premium sipping vodka that's absolutely delightful.
And what exactly does it taste like, Tim?
Okay, well, it's a smooth vodka. It is a sipping vodka, a vodka that you can get a slight creaminess to it. You can tell it's a milk vodka. You can drink it over ice, very, very cold. It's not like a lot of people think, where vodka's there to burn you or a bad memory. This is a wonderful drink, likened to a white whiskey.
So it's a premium product then?
Absolutely, yeah. Super premium product. So made from our sheep on the farm in the Cotswolds. And of course, using the whey, the byproduct or a waste product from the cheese making process, once you've taken the curds away, it seems only right this day and age to make something so lovely from something that typically would be just thrown down the drain.
And is it proving popular?
Absolutely, yeah. We went to market late last summer. Obviously, COVID with everyone has held things back. But we are out and about meeting people, seeing some lovely people trying, tasting, doing some events and shows. People absolutely love it. The idea is obviously to get it well into the market, but it is a small batch product. We're not going to roll it out, spoil it. It's elusive, and only from our vodka farm in the Cotswolds. So the idea is to keep it special, keep it rare, and it's a very, very special drink. You can keep it that way.
Some people might think, it's a bit unusual. You know, vodka coming from sheep, usually associated with coming from potatoes or even sugar beet or something like that.
Absolutely. But what you're looking for is something that has a tangible, workable sugar. And of course, whey has that. So, typically a spirit like this would be from potato or grain or grape. But in this case, you can make vodka from a milk, especially a whey. And that's what we've done. And it has to be tried. It's beautiful.
And what's the best way to try it? Is it with a tonic or is it on its own?
For us to drink Black Lion, it's definitely from the freezer, over ice, as a sipping vodka, possibly an after-dinner drink. Bring the curds back and reunite them with the whey and bring the story and the whole milk back together after you've eaten. Or you could put it in your favourite cocktail. It's very, very versatile.
And if our podcast listeners want to get hold of some, Tim, where can they get it?
So you can buy it online, blacklionvodka.co.uk, and you can also get it in one or two local places to the Cotswolds. But online is best, and you can see the whole backstory about the farm, the sheep, and all about myself and my wife.
That's sheep farmer and vodka maker, Tim Spittle.
So, Johan, vodka from sheep's milk, and it's an interesting concept, isn't it?
It's an interesting concept. There are there are vodkas out there that are made from milk, but this is the only one that, as I understand it anyway, certainly the only one that I've come across that is made from sheep's milk. So I think what they do is it's a part of the cheese making process. The curds go to make the cheese. The whey, as I understand it, makes the vodka. It's fermented into some kind of, you know, a beery sort of type of liquid, and then it's distilled and blended and turned into vodka. And this is a high quality drink here. It's a sipping vodka, so it's creamy and it's for sipping. It's not sort of something. It's not. You know, you're not going to drink gallons and gallons of it. Or,
what you mean? It's not
shots and shots of it.
It's not for shots. It's just a sipping vodka.
Sipping vodka. That's right. That's right. So it's a high quality premium product.
I've never heard of that. A sipping. That's a posh way of saying don't do shots with this.
Exactly. Sip it and enjoy it. That's what it's all about.
There we go. I won't be doing my shot. All right. Okay. Good. Right. So that's great. Thank you for doing that. Next week, Farmers Weekly Podcast, what's coming up?
Next week, Hugh, look, we've already spoken about Alan Partridge and this week's podcast. We know he loved Norfolk. We're actually going to North Norfolk next week to visit a unique sheep grazing project.
You're making that up. You can't be serious.
No, I'm not. No. Yes. Oh, no. Yeah.
That has been the Farmers Weekly Podcast. It's been quite ridiculous, really, for another week. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch, you can. It's podcast@fwi.co.uk. That's podcast@fwi.co.uk. But this has been the Farmers Weekly Podcast for yet another week. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Hugh Broom. Until next week, goodbye.
And I'm Johan Tasker. Goodbye.